Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. As a lawsuit against the state being waged by the Connecticut Coalition for Justice in Educational Funding, a group of parents, teachers, and school boards trying to determine whether the state is spending enough to ensure every student has a quality education, was delayed again last week, shortly before the coalition was rocked by news that Diane Kaplan DeVries, the driving force behind the effort, had lost her battle with cancer. For the People has hosted DeVries a number of times since the lawsuit was filed 5 years ago. So as a tribute to her work and tenacity on behalf of Connecticut students, we're wrapping up the show today, replaying the last interview we hosted with her and the coalition's volunteer president soon after the last delay in the lawsuit occurred. But ahead of that, we're going to remind you about the looming deadline for an annual arts grant program supported by Bob Kaufman and Bob's Furniture Stores, and update you on some incredible news about the Connecticut-based Platform to Employment job creation program being administered by The Workplace. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. The state's Emeritus State Archaeologist is presenting an entertaining and informative presentation on the history and mythologies of vampires in Connecticut, with a focus on remains found in the Jewett City area. This special seasonal program, sponsored by the Naugatuck Valley Audubon Society and the Kellogg Environmental Center, takes place Tuesday, October 20th at 6:30 at the Kellogg Environmental Center in Derby. Learn how research and study of early colonial activities developed the belief of vampires' behavior and the ongoing fear of the undead. Space is limited, so register now by calling 203-734-2513 or emailing donna.kingston@ct.gov. Well, as you heard in the introduction, we're going to open up the program this morning talking to a good and long friend of ours here at the award-winning For the People. Kathy Poulin is with us. You see her putting her feet up and talking about lamps and tables and all kinds of great things, soft mattresses and all the wonderful products at Bob's Discount Furniture on all the commercials that we used to just see here in Connecticut and around New England. But now the great news is that Bob's is moving out well beyond the New England area. It's long had stores in Pennsylvania and Virginia and Maryland, now soon to be in Chicago, which is pretty exciting news, but not just all the exciting news. We're here to remind you that coming up on October 31st is the deadline for Connecticut schools to vie for a $25,000 cultural grant through the Bob's 10th annual Celebrate the Arts contest, and we're on the line with Kathy to talk about it. Kathy, thanks for joining us again today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and this is such an exciting program that we have had for 10 years, just like you mentioned, and one of my favorites because I was a teacher.
Mm-hmm. And so a couple of years ago, there was a little bit of a change. Folks that may remember us talking to you going back many years as this, you know, in the first through the eighth year of the program, when the Bob's circle of stores was a little bit more confined to a fewer states, there were grants that were given out in each of the states. But as the chain grew and the desire to make a greater impression on behalf of the students that are the winners of this grant starting last year, you went to a large single grant that was awarded to one of the applicants. So that is carrying through for this year. One of the applicant schools will win $25,000.
That's correct. And I have to say, you know, it's so funny when people think of Bob, and obviously this is for a good reason. We pummel the radio and TV stations with our advertisements, and people know of us for our great quality furniture and the great value that goes with it. But there's this whole other side to our organization, and it is spearheaded by that very handsome gentleman that I kick back and look at lamps with and hang out on recliners with, Mr. Bob. And he is seriously one of the most philanthropic people I personally know. And I can honestly say, finally, nationally, I think we are known for this, because last year we won the most accredited philanthropic furniture store in the nation. So So that speaks for itself. And I have to applaud him because we would not be doing any of this without him saying, you know what, let's go. This is the right thing to do. And he did it from day one in 91 when he opened his first store in Newington, Connecticut, as you keep pointing out, Connecticut, because that is our home state.
Right. And we're so proud that Bob's continues to call Connecticut home and is now, being represented and representing the state across a growing number of states, going all the way out now to Illinois, which is spectacular. And I have to say, you know, going back even long before the Celebrate the Arts grant, there were many occasions where I was working with or in contact with nonprofit organizations that needed a little bit of help. And, when it ever came to things like bookshelves or lamps or furnishings or things like that, I'd say, well, you know, maybe you want to go and check out Bob's Furniture Warehouse and see if they can, help you out with some items, you know, scratched and dented or whatever. And so many of those organizations would approach Bob and the company, and he'd issue a gift card or a check or make an accommodation for that organization to sort of just come up and load the truck full of what they wanted, and then give them a really good rate for it, and on occasion donate a piece or some pieces outright. So it's not just about the money. It's about all these tiny little seeds of wonderful goodness that get planted all across the Bob's Furniture world have deservingly now resulted in this fantastic award.
Yes, and you nailed it. In 91, when he opened his first door, and I'm telling you, he had very little money in his pocket, he opened the foundation. And if you fast forward now, over $2 million a year goes basically out the door to children-related causes, but it goes much further. Now, outreach, which is the umbrella for this particular contest, is what I helped create with Bob about 15 years ago. I considered it a sprout off the foundation, and outreach is basically different in the fact that we're out there. Bob sits handsomely, as he is handsome, behind his desk, and letters come in, 100, 200 a week for requests for, you know, a fundraiser or a school needing something, and he grants what he can, doing it through the foundation. Outreach is really with my crazy cool vans, hitting the road, showing up at the schools, the walks, the talks, making programs like this one particularly happen, which is amazing. And it's so funny because we give 365 days a year between the foundation and outreach. There is not a stone unturned. And we actually ask. When I open a new store and get into a new community, I literally say on the ribbon cutting day, hey, we just gave $50,000 out to this nonprofit. We did this. Can you please pass this on? Can you pass this information on that we are looking to help? And we mean business. It's not just we're here and we're going to give one time. We give repetitively. We help big organizations. We help smaller organizations. I just came back from Baltimore. I filled 5 youth homes full of furniture because they had nothing for these kids to use.
Yeah.
We help Make-A-Wish children. We help, the list is amazing. And I have to tell you, I am blessed because not only do I get to proudly stand behind him and beside him, but I'm out there every day giving back through our company. And
right.
what a cool job. What
sure.
a blessed job.
Right.
So...
And these days of dwindling budgets, support for the arts, especially at the school level, might be the only opportunity that these young people could get to get that proximity to arts activities. And since this Celebrate the Arts contest began, Bob's has awarded $325,000 just to schools for arts promotion. So in the last few minutes that we have with you, Kathy, for folks that are listening that say, well, geez, we want to get in on that, just like the folks up in Saco, Maine did, they were the first $25,000 winner in the Celebrate the Arts grant last year. So we want to maybe bring that money back to one of the schools here in Connecticut. So tell folks what they need to know to be able to qualify to possibly win this $25,000 Celebrate the Arts grant from Bob's.
Absolutely. It's so simple. And I have to say, I am not a fast typer on the computer. In fact, they call me Fat Fingers. It took me 3 minutes to fill out a simple questionnaire. It's a simple name of school and how long, you know, the school has been, you know, in existence. Do you have arts programs? Things like such as that. And then what it does is randomly put into a drawing. And I am going to give a huge hint here that the more times you enter, the better the chances you are to win, just like that lotto phrase. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to tell you to rally, rally, rally. Get with those PTO presidents. Get with the principal. Put it in the newsletter. Because it seems like whenever I show up with this check, and I personally do show up with a big check, both a big cardboard check and the real check, I have to say there is no better feeling than not only handing the check off, but getting the response back, how did you guys win? And they say, we rallied. We made the town know that this is necessary and you need to enter. And you can enter more than once. It's not like one-time only deal. If you want to stay up all night with a cup of coffee, go for it. So good luck to everybody out there. I know that the need is great. There are cuts everywhere. The arts is one specific area, and we want to be able to help at least one winning school. A $25,000 grant will change a whole school's perception of the arts. So we're very excited for this.
That's great. So I guess my last question is, we know you can go to mybobs.com/celebrate-the-arts to get the direct link. But if people just go to mybobs.com, is there somewhere like easily available on the homepage where they can click on it, or do they have to remember to link through to celebrate-the-arts on the handle?
You know, the quickest way is through that handle, but I want to say that there is a link on our website, but I have to say the new social world, it's on our Facebook. It's socially open for everybody who's out there in that new world that I'm just learning about. And there is just really the quickest way would be just to go onto that landing site that you just mentioned, which is the mybobs.com/celebrate-the-arts.
Great. Great to talk with you. Kathy Poulin, you've seen her on the commercials. She is the spokesperson for Bob's Discount Furniture, and this year is the 10th annual Celebrate the Arts contest, and it'll give one school an opportunity to take in $25,000 to support their arts programs. We hope you'll enter many, many, many times to increase your school's chance of winning right here in Connecticut. Once again, it's mybobs.com/celebrate-the-arts. Kathy, thanks for being part of the program this morning. Well, we love to bring good news. So along with our last interview talking about this great arts grant that is being presented by Connecticut-based Bob's Discount Furniture, we now switch to Bridgeport. And I have to say, from working with a lot of different nonprofits over the years, the measure of the success of nonprofit initiatives and service initiatives is often made by the amount of support those initiatives get, and that amount of support is often gauged on the outcomes. And there's no more worthy program of support than one we've talked about with the gentleman I have on the line right now, Joe Carbone, president and CEO of The Workplace. And I'm talking about the Platform to Employment Initiative. And we have got some incredible, incredible news to boast about as we bring Joe on the program this morning. So, Joe, welcome once again to the For the People, and thanks for joining us.
John, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed it when I've been on your program before, and I must tell your listeners, your program must have a good base, because we get lots of inquiries after you and I have talked in the past.
Well, I'd like to think maybe it even played a small role in the big check that you just are celebrating, and I don't want to give it away. I'll let you do it, because I bet you still almost can't believe it every time you repeat it.
Well, actually, we established a healthcare academy in Lower Fairfield County about 4 years ago. And it was based on a grant that was worth $5 million, $1,250,000 a year for 4 years. And healthcare is a very important part of our economy, because it was the only sector of our economy that continued to grow every single month during the height of the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the easiest place, the best place to move people into employment and perhaps careers. So we apply for a grant for 5 more years to continue the academy as part of the Health Professionals Opportunity Grant Program that's done through the Health and Human Services Department. And we received notification a few days ago that our proposal was approved, and there were hundreds of applicants. And furthermore, we would get $14 million over a five-year period, which makes it more dollars per year over the five-year period than we had anywhere near for the last 4 years. But some pretty lofty goals of, in essence, providing these opportunities to about 1,500 additional people during that period. And by aspiring to get the same result as we did in the first 4 years, which is that 80% of the participants would be hired in training-related occupations once it was completed. So if we did this with this group of 1,500, we're talking about lots of folks who need opportunities of this sort that will have it.
That's great. So briefly, tell us how you apply these annual allocations going forward. How do the dollars translate into both attracting or recruiting individuals in and then bringing them through the training to get placed in a new career in healthcare?
Now, actually, the grant, we need to outreach to people that are on the TANF program, which is a program that provides, you know, financial assistance for the needy, but also the unemployed, also the long-term unemployed, and several other parts of our population or target groups. So we do recruit them, and you need to obviously determine whether or not they have an interest in healthcare, and if they do, if they've got the necessary credentials to kind of participate and give us a reasonable sense that they're going to be successful. And then they started, and we have a very broad base of partners involving virtually every hospital in the region, several smaller, you know, medical facilities, even some medical practices, and even related occupations. But the important thing is that every graduate, we only count success when they've obtained a nationally recognized certificate or credential or degree. So it's not a case of just getting exposure to some healthcare occupations and some things that appear to be growth mechanisms in the economy. Far more important is that they're going to get a tag. They're going to get something that they'll never lose. And our objective thereafter, once they've made the first step, is to kind of stick with them and make sure that they grow that opportunity to a point in which they get something that pays us a lot more than the entry level and that offers them opportunity for continued career advancement.
Well, that's great. And speaking of careers, another exciting thing that's going on at the workplace that we've been talking with you about for several years now is the Platform to Employment Initiative. And we promised we would key in on that during our short time with you this morning, because you're just launching the next phase of that program as we speak, right?
We are. We've already had 1 year involvement doing the entire state of Connecticut. The governor and the legislature gave us $3.5 million in the fiscal year that ended on June 30. And we had success in terms of long-term unemployment that was somewhere in around 88%. And these are all people who have been out of work long enough where they've expired their unemployment benefits. Some were out of work for a year, 2 years, three, and even four. And they were all moving closer towards the regional safety net and entitlement programs. And we had about 88% that we brought to full-time employment. And, you know, that program has now been refunded for 2 years. And it's largely become the basis, the catalyst for what is now really something that's going viral. I mean, we are under contract with several states, counties, cities, all across America to do Platform to Employment in their communities. And the national numbers pretty much reflect what we're doing here in Connecticut. I mean, it confirms and validates the basic principle that if you offer people the appropriate tools and services, they can overcome this. you know, as nasty of a beast as long-term unemployment is, one can beat it if you've got the right tools and services that are available to you. So we're feeling very good about that. I mean, it's now taking on a movement that is carrying lots of current with it and appears to be on the move.
Mm. And the one of the exciting aspects about Platform to Employment, I think, is that it is targeting to some extent not just the long-term unemployed, but the folks who are long-term unemployed. These are individuals, in many cases, who are older members of the workforce who have been secure in their employment for many, many years. They've established homes and families and lifestyles. They're playing roles in their communities, and suddenly the rug is pulled out from under them, and they're hoping to transition into new employment, but they continue to keep hitting barriers, or they continue to, you know, not set the hook when it comes to the job interview. And these are people, in many cases, considering all that they've built up around them, that have the greatest propensity for disaster if they don't reconnect with employment. So for many people, this is a lifesaver, the Platform to Employment program.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought the subject up of older workers. It just so happens that about 45% to 47% of the participants of the program, and it doesn't matter if you're a participant in California, in Illinois, or anywhere in the nation, any of the 50 states, about that percentage are people that are over 50, and they are facing a double whammy out there. I mean, I'm not calling it official discrimination, but I think what happened in the Great Recession is that many more liberties were kind of assigned to employers to construct or assemble the kind of a workforce that they needed in order to have the best opportunity to survive and to grow and to compete. And in many cases, it involved a thought that if you're younger, you're more tech savvy, you may be less set in your ways, more willing to learn different things. You may cost less because your medical cost will be less. All kinds of biases that were created against this population, and very unfortunate. But we have no different experience with people over 50 than we do with people under 50 on Platform to Employment. It's getting people to have a chance to demonstrate, to compete, and demonstrate that they can do the job as well as anybody else. So it's sort of a knee-jerk reaction when you look at. You'll post a job this morning. You'll have 300 applicants by 5 o'clock because it's easy now to apply. And you'll find ways to kind of cut the pack down to a more reasonable number to look at. And you can easily look at people that are 50 and older and say, well, you know, my perception is that they're tired, they're done, and their cost is going to be too high for me. And that being the case, they don't get a chance to really compete. Mm. But what we do under Platform to Employment is that our relationship to employers makes it so that they're free of risk. They have no reason to not consider this group. So what we've done here in the program is to demonstrate statistically that's a terrible policy. Not only is it discriminatory and it's un-American, that these folks do have a lot to contribute, and the only thing that stands in the way is to give them a chance to compete. So once you have moved aside that barrier and they have a free environment to offer the ways in which they will do that job well, they have the same chance of getting hired as anybody else does. So it's one of those things. I mean, we're proud about a lot of parts of Platform to Employment and what this whole experience has been. But I think we've dealt directly with the kind of discrimination that older workers are facing, and the results are proving for themselves that those employers that decide that they're just going to make certain kinds of assumptions when it comes to older workers are doing a disservice not just to the individual and to the tenets of being an American, but perhaps to themselves as well.
Yeah. Well, I have to say in closing that from the Healthcare Academy to Platform to Employment and all the other initiatives, the workplace has really come forward to also represent Connecticut extremely proudly. And for folks who aren't aware of it, the workplace mission is to develop a well-educated, well-trained, and self-sufficient workforce that can confidently compete in today's changing global marketplace. If you want to learn more about what this organization has to offer, or you want to get involved with it as a supporter, please go to workplace.org. Our guest this morning is Joe Carbone. He's president and CEO of The Workplace, doing such fantastic work and always a great resource and a great voice to our program. So, Joe, thanks for kind of checking in with us and letting us know about these fantastic latest developments. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Ansonia Nature and Recreation Center welcomes new volunteers who are willing to help with the reception center, or maybe you're into animal care, trail maintenance, or helping with mailings or organizing special events. Volunteers are an essential part of the Nature Center, so whatever the interest or availability, check out the variety of exciting opportunities throughout the year, or plan to attend the center's next fall foliage ranger hike. It's absolutely free and happening Sunday, October 25th at 1 p.m. Join the Nature Center Naturalist for a stroll through woodlands, old fields, and wetlands, and enjoy the beauty of the crisp fall air while learning about New England's flora and fauna. Just wear appropriate shoes for this moderate hike and register in advance. Once again, the event is free, and to find out about all the Ansonia Nature Center programs or volunteering, call 203-736-1053 or just click on ansonianaturecenter.org. Well, I'm pleased to be out in the field today with a little bit of a different group of guests than we normally get when we take our microphone out into the state of Connecticut. Today, we're pleased to be sitting with the project director for the Connecticut Coalition for Justice in Educational Funding, CCJEF. Director Diane DeVries is with us. She's one of the leading experts in the country on public school funding and organized the coalition about 10 years ago. We're also joined by another gentleman who I call a friend and a longtime acquaintance. Herb Rosenthal is the president and Newtown representative on the CCJEF steering committee. He's also the former Newtown first selectman, a chairman and member of the Newtown Board of Education in his tenure, in his past, I should say. And he is also a former president of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. So he's going to bring a unique viewpoint to this interview, and I'm thrilled to be here talking to both of them. So first, for folks who may have been longtime listeners to the program, we have had Diane on the show now going back all these 10 years. So let's hearken back to the very beginning, Diane, and just give folks listening a little bit of a reminder on from whence you came.
Yes, thank you, John, for inviting us. In 2005, the Connecticut Coalition of Justice and Education Funding filed a lawsuit called CJEF versus REL. It is against the state of Connecticut. It is basically an adequacy and equity case that also brings in a prayer for property tax relief. The coalition, by the way, is a group of municipalities, school districts, the alphabet soup of education professional associations, the teachers' unions, and a couple of other big unions whose employees work in our schools, and other interested Connecticut taxpayers and advocates for education. We have grown to be quite a group. All told, we represent over half of Connecticut's public school children, about three-quarters of all the free reduced lunch children, three-quarters of the English language learners, and a large majority of minorities as well. So we have brought the case. We have had a very long haul of this, as you can tell. In most states, when these cases are raised, they go to trial within 2 or maybe 3 years. In our case, it's going to be very close to 10 years. We did, however, take a side trip, which is really important for your listeners to know about. A trial judge found for the state early on when the state claimed that under the Connecticut Constitution there is no right to a quality education or suitable in the terms of the statutes. And that, yes, free and equal, but it couldn't be of any specified quality. Well, we weren't going to let that stand. In other words, they were questioning the validity of our claims for adequacy, which is the current constitutional claims that most of these school finance lawsuits across the nation are based upon. And that is, schools must be funded commensurate with the learning needs of the students they serve.
Now, you bring up an interesting point when you talk about other states. How many other states or municipal or state government entities are engaged in something similar to what we have going on here in Connecticut that the coalition is working toward?
Well, that's a difficult question to ask because we're all in very different stages.
Oh, okay.
I think we are the only ones that's scheduled to go to trial this fall. There are several that are waiting for final Supreme Court decisions in their states.
Yeah, but when we first met, this was a groundbreaking national initiative. So it remains that way because the potential civil action is still on schedule, to the best of our
knowledge. Yes, we're being watched very carefully because, of course, Connecticut is a high spending state. It's an expensive state to live in. We have high teacher salaries, high cost of living, and we actually are investing more than the national average in our students. But of course, the cost of living is far above the national average. So from that perspective, they're watching us. We're also the first of the lawsuits to incorporate the notion of that funding should not be on the backs of local property taxes. Many of the others in recent years have sort of meandered around that notion, but they haven't directly hit it head on as we are. Mm-hmm. We're also the first lawsuit in the nation, and that's another reason we're getting watched very carefully, that have had a law school represent them pro bono. Yale Law School, back in 2004, as I was forming this coalition, came forward and said, we will represent you on the merits of your claims. This is first and foremost a civil rights case, and we will work with you. And so over the course of these years, we've had close to 250 different Yale Law School students working on this case, and a variety of supervising clinical faculty, and they've done a phenomenal job. In May of 2012, with the help of the dean of the Yale Law School, he was able to reach out and pull in offers of big major law firms mm-hmm. to help us for the actual litigation of the case. And the one we ultimately chose is Debevoise & Plimpton, one of the nation's largest law firms based in New York City. So we are very privileged to have them, again, doing it pro bono, and the Yale students working with that firm, which is a brand new experience for a law school. And it has worked out tremendously. Let me just get back to that 2010 sidestep we made here mm-hmm. when the judge declared that, no, under the Constitution, he doesn't think there's a right for a quality education, but he's really not all that sure, sort of set it up for the appeal. And we immediately took the bite and said, yes, we're appealing this. We're not going to let that stand. Mm-hmm. This would be forever unfair to children. We appealed it, and 23 months later, the Supreme Court in Connecticut ruled not only in our favor, but above and beyond what we had expected. Not only is there a fundamental right for every child to have a quality education, and the state must pay for it, by the way, but also they went on to set the standards for how this will be judged when it comes to this trial on the merits of the case. And that included things like, it's not enough to say there's a fundamental right. Remember, that fundamental right was established under Horton versus Meskel back in the 1977 decision. But that fundamental right is not an empty shell. You can't just use those words. They have to mean something. And how could you mean anything about it being fundamental if it's not a quality education? And went ahead and set the kinds of things that must be, that students must be able to graduate and go on to college and careers ready for those adventures. They must have the simple instrumentalities that we expect in any school, like paper and pens and computers and teachers and reasonable class sizes and all those things. So it was exactly the kind of guidance we needed to have for the trial court. And then, of course, they remanded it to the trial court, which is Hartford Superior Court, for a full trial on both the adequacy and the equity challenges. So that's where we are heading towards in September.
Okay. Well, we'll come back and talk about some of the anticipatory elements as we move through the spring and into the summer, heading toward that auspicious date. And for folks that just tuned in, we're having a very spirited conversation with the founder and project director, Diane DeVries, of the Connecticut Coalition for Justice and Educational Funding, CCJEF. We're also pleased to be joined by Herb Rosenthal, who is president and Newtown representative on the CCJEF Steering Committee. He was first elected to the Newtown Board of Education, became its chair, then was elected numerous terms as Newtown's first selectman. During that time, he rose through the ranks to eventually become president of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. He has attended and represented Connecticut and its municipalities and towns and cities, both here in the state and across the country in that capacity. Pleased to welcome him for his perspective. So, Herb, tell us a little bit about when you first heard about CCJEF, and was it something that you wanted to get behind, both as a community leader and as someone who sees the benefit of a quality education for all of Connecticut's children?
Well, I think you hit some of the reasons. I first learned of CCJEF from CCM. It was a Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. I think Jim Finley, the former executive director, talked at a meeting about what was going on, as CCM had been involved with assisting CJEF to a certain extent. And I knew about it, but I had some interest, but I was busy with a lot of things, and I really didn't do much in the very beginning. 2004, I probably heard, maybe 2005. And then I was actually visited one day by a couple of Newtown residents, Poe Murray and Sarah Beyer, who were parents and active in the education community in Newtown. Mm-hmm. And in the course of one of those meetings, I think it was Poe, it may have been Sarah and Poe, but said she had been to a meeting, learned a lot about CJEF, and thought that Newtown should get involved. And she had gone to the Board of Ed, really didn't have much success with them joining, but she talked to me about it. And so as a result, can't remember whether I contacted Diane or she contacted me, but after talking with Diane, I said, for those of you who've been listening, her passion and her expertise convinced me that Newtown should participate, and that it would be beneficial to our students and taxpayers. And also, it's just a general philosophy of the importance of providing quality and equity in the education area for children in the state of Connecticut. We can't live in little islands. I mean, even if our children in Newtown are being fairly well educated, mostly on the backs of Newtown taxpayers, I might add, about 90% probably, or more, property owners are paying the bill. But just because they're getting a pretty good education that way, a good education, we still have a responsibility to our neighbors in other parts of the state and nearby. It impacts all of us when children aren't getting a quality education. Mm-hmm. So for those reasons, I decided to join, and it's been very rewarding, even though it's volunteering my time here, mm-hmm. I find it very rewarding exercise. And, Diane has always continued to impress me with her ability in leading the organization.
So as someone who has represented the school community as the chairman of a board of education and then an entire community as first selectman, what do you see as being the real challenge here in trying to reach the point of achievement for what CCJEF has set out to do? From a municipal standpoint, or from an educational entity standpoint, what are the biggest challenges as we sort of cast our eyes towards September and hopefully this trial?
Well, you know, we're certainly optimistic about the our case. We feel our lawyers have done a great job. We feel the facts are with us. At this point, we would really wish the state of Connecticut would argue the case on the merits. We're willing to argue the case on the merits. We're not playing a lot of legal maneuvering and legal games. And if the state would just do what Dan Malloy said it should do when he was the mayor of Stamford and was one of the founding members of the lawsuit, because he believed the state wasn't living up to its obligations, if the state would just say, okay, we're just, you know, we'll present our facts, you present yours, and we'll see where it comes down in court. Instead, they've been throwing everything but the kitchen sink at us and trying every way to delay this case and try to discourage us from proceeding. And it's really disheartening to see the state. Other states have, I think Massachusetts was one where they had sort of a cooperative litigation. But Connecticut, it's actually gotten tougher, believe it or not. I believe our issues and relationship with the state attorneys and the state government has actually gotten tougher since Dan Malloy was elected governor than it was even under the prior administration when the lawsuit started. So that's been discouraging, but I am optimistic that when we get to trial that we're going to prevail.
Right. Well, before we went on the air this morning, Diane DeVries, the founder and project director for the Connecticut Coalition for Justice and Educational Funding, was talking about some of the issues involved here. So let's briefly run through the agenda, Diane, if you could. Just to kind of defining adequacy and equity and property tax relief, so we can then go on and talk a little bit about why the property tax relief component really is could bring historical changes to the way Connecticut runs its government and funds its government and programs.
Well, very simply, adequacy is twofold. Adequate education is a quality education for every child, regardless what that child's learning problems are when they come to the school. At the same time, adequacy is adequacy of funding. So it's a two-level definition. The same thing goes for equity. We want an equitable education. Why shouldn't a child in Bridgeport get the same quality of education that a child in New Canaan gets? Same thing goes for funding, the equity of funding. Why is it that a mill rate in one city for education, I'm just talking for education, is not the same as a mill rate for education in another city? Unfortunately, we have the reverse happening. We have high mill rates in the cities that can least afford it, where the population can least afford it, and yet their schools are in the most precarious of positions, and the student achievement is abominable, quite frankly, unconscionable. And then property tax. I mean, property tax is a very clear issue here. The inequity of a regressive tax like that has long been talked about. But again, as I mentioned to you earlier, we have reached the limits of what we can expect from children with the incessant testing, from their teachers with the now it's going to be incessant evaluation and testing, and increasingly ever-increasing class sizes and fewer resources, and their schools. The limits on those. We have reached the limits on the property tax. At this point, we have to do something. It is no longer sustainable for the schools. It's no longer sustainable for property tax owners and municipalities. We've got to change this whole system. And that's what this case is about. We are challenging the constitutionality of the entire school funding system. Mm-hmm. That means not just the education cost-sharing grant, you know, the ECS grant that all the school districts look toward for their operating costs, for a small portion of their operating costs, I should say, witness Newtown. But also we're talking about the inter-district magnet schools, the vocational technical high schools, charter schools, you name it. Any kind of educational facility, preschool is part of this lawsuit. Mm. All of this, the entire school funding system, how we raise the money, at what level we fund the schools, how we know how what level to fund the schools, and how we distribute the pot of money that the general fund will bring in. All of those things are on the table with this lawsuit.
So is it fair to suppose that the greatest resistance toward, as Mr. Rosenthal pointed out, going to trial and trying this on its merits, is it the prospect that this is a little snowball at the top of a mountain that will have massive and far-reaching implications throughout not only the government structure, but the way Connecticut has gone about funding itself and its operations, both at the state and municipal levels, if this case is successful? Will it demand the ripple effect of change, or can it exist without any really fundamental changes in the way Connecticut's government handles its money?
I think the snowball effect is a great analogy, and I think the snowball is already going down the mountain. And indeed, there are already other groups that are talking about total tax restructuring, using the lawsuit as the catalyst. Following the HUD regionalization notions for planning districts and so on and so on. Whether that comes out as an offshoot of this lawsuit, I don't know. But certainly things of that nature may be planned in order to raise the revenues. Herb, you must have something.
Yeah, Connecticut has long been, if not the most, one of the most property tax-dependent states in the country for funding municipal services. And I think in education we might be number one. New Jersey's been pretty high also in the use of, reliance on property tax. But so that was part of the Newtown issue for me is that, as we said earlier, most of local education in Newtown is funded through property taxes. And our property taxpayers have made it clear that they're stretched about as far as they feel that they can be to support education. The state did make a commitment many years ago, Horton versus Peskel, and then back in 87 we had the Equity Act, Education Equity, and it was going to be 50%. The state was going to provide 50%, not for Newtown, but 50% across the board. I don't think we got into the 40s at one point, but we're down in the 30s somewhere now. I'm not sure what the number is anymore, but we've just never gotten there. And CCM had many studies over the years, and over 80% of the people answering the surveys consistently said that the property tax is the most unfair of all taxes. The income tax fares much better in people's minds as a fair tax than the property tax. And so some form of restructuring, I think, has to happen, because I just think we're at the breaking point for having property taxes foot the bill here.
So as the former president of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities and a former town leader, you interact with CCM members and others who are not affiliated with that group. What creates the disparity? What are you hearing out on the front lines in terms of why certain towns like Stamford and former Mayor Malloy and Newtown and Bridgeport and several others really latched onto this early on and really put a lot of energy and in some cases resources behind it? And other municipalities are completely, hands off and step away from it. Where do you see that, or what do you hear about why certain officials or certain municipalities are embracing the Connecticut Coalition for Justice and Educational Funding and others are not?
Well, there's always a certain amount of, people are busy with a lot of different things. The mayors and first selectmen and superintendents have a lot of things on their plate that take their attention. And there also is a little bit of the And I think we've all done it. There have been cases that I've seen towns on other issues involved in, and I wasn't not interested, but, you know, it just didn't come to the and felt that we'll all benefit from it, whether I get involved or not, we'll still all benefit from it. So I think if you really ask most of the mayors and first selectmen who know anything about this case, most of them feel they would like us to be successful. They feel everybody will benefit. But whether or not they have the time, energy, or can commit the resources to participating, that's another story. Mm-hmm. I don't know of anyone who said, "Oh, I don't think this is a good idea. I hope the state wins," or what have you. Mm-hmm. I just think it's people have different levels of commitment to it. Even though they all believe education is important, and I think I go to meetings. I'm still on the board of the Connecticut Conference. In fact, I'm the chairman of the Budget and Personnel Committee. Mm-hmm. But they all are hurting with their local budgets trying to fund education. I don't think whether it's the big cities, maybe hurt a little more, or the smaller towns. Some of the really small towns that are poor, I think are sometimes harder pressed than some of the bigger cities. I mean, there's some very small municipalities. Diane would know the names better than I would, which ones, but. This is a pretty universal problem in Connecticut. I mean, it may not be recognized by a town that has a great school system and has a lot of money, and they may not immediately, maybe it doesn't rise to the level that it does in some other places. But I don't think there'd be anybody who wouldn't think that there has to be an overall restructuring for how we do this in Connecticut, fund education.
So in the last couple of minutes that we have, and we'll go back to Diane to wrap it up, you know, CCJEF, you know, came out of the gate. It got a lot of press. There a lot of entities have joined on. Then it sort of gyrated in the legal actions and things. It's kind of been off the radar, way off to the side of the radar for quite a while. Now it's coming back, and we're obviously leading the charge in promoting the fact that the alleged September court date is coming. So what would you say to folks in municipalities across the state whose school districts or towns have not been a part of this? Is now the time for solidarity amongst all Connecticut cities and towns over this issue?
Well, I think it is, because they'll all benefit one way or another. I think every municipality, every child in the state will benefit if we're successful in this lawsuit. The benefits may be greater in some municipalities than in others, or more easily recognizable, perhaps. But I don't think there's any question that every municipality, every school child in the state will benefit by our being successful. And I know I was a little harsh in my talking about, you know, the state and in the legal aspects of the case. I'm not saying that the governor and the legislature haven't done anything to benefit education. There have been some strides made. Unfortunately, they're just not, perhaps it's due to the economic climate in the state or whatever, they're just not going at the rate that it needs to go in order to really make an impact.
Right.
So I don't want it to seem that the governor doesn't care or the legislature doesn't care. I'm sure they do.
They're viewing the side effects of the treatment,
and I think the big
as being
and the big issue is, I think we see we're in an economic hole right now, and there's a lot of economic wins, you know, for the state in the next two budgets, from what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that's part of it. Thinking, well, how do we fund this thing, and how do we make it work? We'd love to have that conversation, actually, and you know, with them, but so far we haven't been able to. But that's
great. Herb Rosenthal, president and Newtown representative on the Connecticut Coalition for Justice and Educational Funding Steering Committee. He's a former Newtown First Selectman and Board of Education member and chairman, also former president and still active with the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. Diane DeVries, for the last word, I really have to hold you to a minute or so because we've gone way over, but that's we've got a couple more moments for some thoughts. Along with our promise to come back and visit with you again before, and hoping that September date is good. From your perspective, what do folks who are listening to this program this morning need to do to bring this effort to fruition, at least to the extent of having the case, as Herb pointed out, heard on its merits?
Well, I encourage everyone who's listening to go to the website, look us up, ccjef.org. Our contact information is there. Get in touch with us. We'll come. We'll talk with you. We'll talk with the decision makers in your community, in your school district. Every school district in this state ought to be a member of CJEF. And almost every municipality, I'd say all municipalities, but that's never going to happen. Mm. But this is in our common good. It is for the future of our children, the future of our commerce, the future of our state, and our values as a great place to live. This is what we need to move forward.
Very good. With an agenda focusing on adequacy, equity, and property tax relief, the CCJEF really touches every single person here in the state of Connecticut. If you don't have children or you don't have children in schools, it's still critically important as this case moves toward trial with the hopeful projected date for September. So once again, I want to thank Herb Rosenthal and Diane DeVries for being on the program this morning, and we'll be talking about, and you'll be hearing about, the Connecticut Coalition for Justice and Educational Funding, as you have since the organization formed now 10 years ago. And we thank you both for being on the program. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.